Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Frontside Podcast, episode 36. My name is Charles. With me is also Stanley.
Hello. Hi. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing?
Good. People have heard me before. I'm not going to do a long introduction. So
we've also got Rob, who's with us.
Hello. I'm a developer here. I don't know if anybody recognizes that.
And Brandon.
Hi. Yes, it's me. I'm back. I also develop software at the Frontside, ostensibly. And with us, we have a guest, the inimitable Trek Glowacki from Chicago, who it sounds like it may be snowing up there. Trek, do you want to say hi and kind of introduce yourself to the...
Yeah. Hi, I'm Trek, software developer as well. Not at your company, though, at a different company. And you've probably seen me in the Ember community. I do a lot of little things. This is like three awkward first dates all at once. this is fantastic. I'm going to bring my A game date material.
All right.
Mostly vaudeville jokes. I just flew in from vaudeville.
And boy, are my tired references tired. Trek, I'm so glad to have you back. We had a really great conversation last time, and I learned a lot from talking with you last time, but we left one topic on the table that we didn't get to discuss as much as I wanted to, and which is why we were like, okay, we've got to bring Trek back to talk about this. So to kind of set the stage for what we're hoping to talk about today and hope people kind of take away from this is you kind of introduced a different paradigm for thinking about UI than I had ever seen a couple years ago at Ember Camp. I think we linked to it in the show notes then, and we'll do it again here. But I think it's really important. It's a short 20-minute talk. And it kind of lit a candle for me in my brain about how UIs could be composed out of smaller things, but I was never able to click that into reality. And it seems like just now that's starting to happen. And so, but the idea of composing UI out of reusable components, even though the word and the terminology and all that stuff hadn't really taken root yet in the JavaScript community, was pretty revelatory for me. And I wanted to bring you back to talk about it and see what's changed in the last couple of years. And now that we've had an opportunity to start messing around with some of that stuff and ship some projects that are sort of inspired by that idea. But I wanted to ask you, first off, so you didn't mention where you're working and if you guys are hiring and what you kind of work on there now.
Mm-hmm. I will gladly do that. I work at a company called Popular Pays. We're here in Chicago. We are the business term is a native advertising platform, which is essentially, it's like promotions. So, I'm drinking fine Familia Camarena tequila, one of my favorite tequilas. And I'll be posting to my Twitter and Instagram accounts about how much I like them. And then they will give me money. They're not compensating me. This is just a tequila I quite enjoy. So that's what our company does. We basically help connect brands with people who have social media presences and help them get sort of either better content for advertising. Actually, a lot of our business is just people generating good content or, you know, posting about goods and services that they really like. Yes, you'll be shocked to hear we are hiring. It's a web application. We have an iOS is the main sort of UI right now. All the code's Ruby, JavaScript, Objective-C right now, but hopefully Swift for the iOS stuff.
Okay.
It's a fun company. I really like it. My previous gig, I was at Groupon. You perhaps have heard of them. They sell hot yoga coupons on the internet. And just like a bad fit for me. But I'm just like so, so happy at my current place. It's kind of ridiculous.
That's really cool. And then you're talking to us from ReactConf live right now, which is, I appreciate you taking time away from that.
Live from ReactConf. Yeah, I'm giving my talk of you're doing it wrong. You should be using Ember, Reactor's experience.
You're on stage right now, right?
At this very moment.
This is awkward. I'm sorry, audience.
so awkward. So actually, I mean, when you bring up ReactConf, there was like a radio or podcast at its finest. There was a talk that I have since watched, but they just had a graphic up that was like basically a like learning curve of the various technologies, React, Redux, and Relay, and talking about like when to use each of them. But my interpretation of that curve was basically like, oh, you're screwed no matter what you do. Because if you start out just using React, you rapidly hit an application complexity where you're now frustrated with just React. If you start using Relay, you're frustrated at the start, and maybe it gets better if your application happens to grow. So it's interesting. Like, I saw that chart, and I'm like, wow, I remember, like, I think someone had that exact chart at an Ember conference 3 years ago about Ember. So it's fun. It's fun to see, like, the other communities walking through some of the same sort of application structural problems that we have to do in Ember.
Yeah, it is weird. You see that, like, maturation cycle. Mm-hmm. But they also had some different ideas that have brought some, have sort of brought some additional, like, friction that has sort of sharpened and knocked some of the rough edges off of Ember, which has been really cool.
Yeah, definitely. I've actually been a huge React fan since almost the beginning of React generally, but
since before it was cool. Yeah.
Since before it was cool. Yes. I think React came out, full disclosure of what it was like to be on Ember Core at the time, we had, you know, we've been around for a while. We survived the framework wars of 2011 and are arguably, like, you know, the one of the three big survivors of that time period, maybe four if you count Backbone. And, you know, there were dozens at the time that people mostly have moved away from at this point. But I remember we were, you know, working really, really hard, and then people were talking heavily about Backbone, and it was all about Backbone versus Ember. And we sort of nervously were like, oh, yeah, we should go look at Backbone. And we look at Backbone and just be like, what, really? We're not even solving the same kind of problems. It's just absolutely ridiculous. So we just kind of, like, the Backbone people, there was some useful stuff to learn from there, but it was like, where we're going, I think we're going to be better than Backbone. And then Angular got really popular, and we're like, oh boy, Angular, here we go. It's going to be another thing. So we looked into it, and it's like, really? People prefer this? Oh, I mean, that's never going to be our audience. But we pulled in some things that we liked from Angular. And I think, honestly, React happened, and we were like, you know, this was like the seventh time someone's like, oh, Ember is awful, but technology, you know, new Pepsi is so much more delicious. And I think we were a little slow to actually go and look at what was going on in the React world, because it felt like, oh, you know, we've played this game before. We're going to go look, and it's going to be like, oh, people like it because it's new, but there's not a lot to be learned there. But, you know, it turns out we were still like 3-4 months behind, but we did go look at it, and, you know, like the simpler programming model, and then obviously the more the better rendering that you can get from it was very, very appealing. And yeah, it's making its way into Ember very slowly, but surely.
I remember being at JSConf when Facebook got up on stage. They were a sponsor that year, I think they were introduced that way. My memory is a little fuzzy around this, but they get up and they start talking about React, and like what I remember the most was like, they were really trying to sell JSX a lot. And, it, like, the reaction to that, like, their first talk did not really go over well. And so I think Ember was kind of also behind because everyone else was. It wasn't until like 6 months later at JSConfU, Pete Hunt, who has really helped push React forward a lot, does this talk, and it's like, React is not like anything you've used before, and here's why, and maybe it's simpler. And like, then that was like a moment for people to be like, oh, I get it now.
Yeah. It's tough. You have a thing that you really like, and you've been along for the whole ride. And so you're kind of frog boiled on its good points and its bad points. And it becomes very hard to describe. Like, even I would actually have troubles, like, you know, what are the selling points of Ember? I'd be like, it's good. and it's nice to see outsider perspective, because you can understand where other people are coming from and really refine your message and do a better job of explaining what is good about the tools that you work with, and also what's bad about the tools that you work with. I think the two-way data binding in Ember was a good pattern at the time. One-way data binding is very clearly much easier to work with. But I think the thing that React, like, really brought home, we should all, you know, applaud Facebook for devoting probably millions of dollars of research to this, was the notion of, like, the virtual DOM and the, like, oh, just re-render everything. Because at face value, that sounds like impossible. There's no way that you can do that performantly. But they really demonstrated, yeah, you can. But, you know, again, they talk about performance is not the main thing in React that's interesting. It's the simpler programming model, which does actually, so we're ostensibly going to talk about composable UIs and UI patterns. I think React, when it came out, was further along that path than Ember was at that same time. Which is what made it very compelling to me.
So I want to go back to your talk at EmberCamp. It seems sort of, I think it seems prescient now, because this is actually how people are building their UIs in the age of like React components and the way that Ember is very component driven now. Literally none of this stuff existed at the time. So at your, what inspired you to give your EmberCamp talk? And can you talk a little bit about what you talked about there and what inspired you to give that talk?
Definitely. So the talk was, God, how long? That was a long time
ago. It was like almost 3 years ago.
12?
Yeah, it was actually exactly 3 years ago.
Oh, yeah, because it was like
Valentine's Day. Time.
Oh, yeah, I remember it was on Valentine's Day, and a bunch of people were mad about that.
My wife included,
I didn't even know, because I'm desperately single. Hey, boys.
Hint.
Hint. I had a wonderful time visiting your city of Austin, tasting the local flavor, if you will.
Mm-hmm. It's a good city.
We had tacos. We went for tacos. It was delicious. Yeah, that was a long time ago. So that talk was about, a bit about my background. I've been doing software development for, I think this is my 16th year. So I feel ancient. oh God.
Do you want, so, that's, oh my God, that's
Rob,
so long.
Rob, you're about to not help. What were you doing 16 years ago, Rob?
I was in diapers, maybe. not really.
No, I'm sure you were not.
Maybe just learning my ABCs.
Wow. so I've, I'm internet friends with Sebastian McKenzie and James Kyle, who are both much younger than me.
They're on the
Babel core team. And the stuff they talk, like Sebastian was installing Windows 98 just to see what it was like. I'm like, why? He's like, I was six months old when this came out. Oh my God, no.
He did this like amazing tweet stream. He like went and like installed like some current or recent version of Firefox and was like, oh my God, like look at this thing. Like, it was just incredible.
It's absolutely amazing.
Windows XP was my first operating system that I used for real.
Or if anyone needs me, I'll be on the roof.
Take a sip of that tequila. It's
so,
all okay.
So I've been programming for, not a long time, right? Like but fairly long, right? For web programming, like web programming didn't exist for very much longer before I started my career doing it. And this will only continue to be a depressing thing for me. So I've been doing this for a while and I have.
We're here for you. Sorry, I just wanted to say,
thank you.
It's good. Let it out.
This is the best therapy session I've had in a while.
And now drink.
Don't worry, I'm going to. We should talk about I had a first date last night. That's quite good. So, this is not the tequila talking. I haven't even finished my first shot of it. So I've been doing this for a while, and have recently in my career. Well, it's not recently anymore. Like past 6 or 7 years, 8 years. Shifted more towards doing user interfaces, and as part of that career shift away from more services, I went and got a degree in human computer interaction at the University of Michigan, and HCI is all about like interfaces, and I got introduced to many of these ideas. I can't claim most of these ideas are in fact new. Like many things in computer science, especially on the web, we're just like reinventing or rediscovering basically what people who invented Lisp knew 35 years ago. So that's gonna be a fun thing when there's like the next cycle where everyone reinvents all this stuff. So I've been doing HCI related stuff for a while and was introduced into a lot of the heavy thinking and research around interfaces, both from a human standpoint, so how do humans interact with interfaces, and from a programmer's standpoint of like how do we craft interfaces in a way that limits complexity and increases reuse. And the research around it, a lot of it comes from the 90s, mid-90s up to the late 90s, talking about reuse. And the dichotomy that researchers sort of narrowed down to is this concept of reuse in the small versus reuse in the large. Reuse in the small, you're probably familiar with, that is, at the time they would have called them like, you know, coroutines or functions, which is just like a thing that takes an input and emits an output. And you use them by, you know, bringing them into your application, sending data into them, and getting the return results out. Reuse in the large is intended to cover much more than that. So instead of input and output, there's input but also internal state, and it tends to cover sort of multiple slices of concern. Typically, it'll have both user presentation, flow control, data persistence, and validation, all in sort of one unit. And so the examples I use when I'm talking about these, people are very familiar with reuse in the small. So if you think of like underscore Lodash or any library that is just functions, like pure functions, is reuse in the small. Reuse in the large is something more like WordPress or TinyMCE, the text editor, where all the necessary parts of it, from what the user sees to how data flows through it to how it's persisted and synchronized between different stages, is all contained. And you tend to customize these through option passing. TinyMCE is sort of the extreme version of it. I think I counted them once. There were like 178 different options you could set on TinyMCE. Some of them like mutually incompatible. Like you can't set two of them at the same time, because like what would the code even know what to do with these two things? And in many ways, they just rely on like no sane person would set these two things to these two flags at the same time, because what would it even mean? And in terms of web UIs, I think we've never really hit a good stride for reuse. If you think of the primary paradigm for reuse in the browser land up until 2011, 2012, the sort of pinnacle of that was like jQuery plugins. And they tend to encapsulate all of these things. So if you think of like a jQuery autocompleter, the way that as a consumer you consume it is you say, $.autocomplete or autocompleter or type ahead or whatever the plugin happens to be called. And you can pass some options to that, and it controls rendering to the page, handling user interaction, re-rendering parts of the page, making data communication back and forth between a server. And the way you customize it is you'll pass options like, here's my data source, it's all local, or here's a URL where you can go get remote data. Here's the div you can decorate the dropdown with if I want particular styling. And that works quite well until you need to do customization, which is where it usually falls apart. And my absolute favorite quote about this, I should have led with this quote because it's so good. There's a book from like 1998 or 99. Let me find my quote. I actually like noted this earlier because it was so good. The book is from 1999. It is called The Grammar of Graphics. And it was part of my grad school course. Leland Wilkinson is the author, and he's writing specifically about charts and graphs and how to write a charting and graphing library. And the quote is, if we endeavor to develop a charting instead of a graphing program, we will accomplish two things. First, we will inevitably offer fewer charts than people want. Second, our package will have no deep structure. Our computer program will be unnecessarily complex because we will fail to reuse objects or routines that function similarly in different charts. And we will have no way to add new charts to our system without generating new complex code. Elegant design requires us to think about a theory of graphics, not charts. So what he's basically advocating for there is the same thing I was talking about in my talk, which is although the promise of, for example, a fully built graphing library is its ease of use, you run out of runway very, very quickly. And probably people have seen this if they've ever tried to use a graphing library. You're like, I want to make a bar chart. And you're like, make a bar chart, cool. And then the minute you need, a customer or someone in your business asks you to customize it a particular way, and there's no option that allows you to do that.
You groan.
Yeah, what do you do, right? Like, what do you do? If there's not an option, what do you do? And the only answer I've ever seen is, well, you crack open the source code, thank the stars for open source, and you start editing the source, and you make it do what you want to do. But of course, you're then forking the project and opting out likely of easy upgrade paths for bug fixes, performance things. It's really, really tough. So Wilkinson is arguing here that like you should not build a charting library. Like that is a fool's errand in and of itself. What you should be building.
You should build like D3, right?
Exactly. D3 is the exact example of this. In fact, I'm pretty sure Mike Bostock uses that quote somewhere on the D3 site. I've seen him use. I know he's read that book because I've seen quotes from that book through the D3 documentation quite a bit. And D3 is a great example of this. If you've ever tried to learn D3, as I have, you realize if you're trying to learn D3 under a deadline because you need to make a bar chart, oh, you are in for a world of hurt. Just a world of hurt. Because it is like the underlying grammar of a language, but that does not tell you how to write a paragraph, let alone a novel. But when you master that, you were able to write any paragraph in any novel that you want to write, which is the real skill of, you know, like solid engineering, if you will. And D3 is like in many ways ahead of its time in thinking about these things. I'm super happy to see these days charting libraries come out that are built on D3 and specifically expose parts of themselves whereas a consumer, you can actually get to the D3 underpinnings. And then that's basically how they say, like, here's how you customize, here's how you override, here's how you provide your own visual elements. You need to learn D3. And then, like, you know, you stick your D3 code in here, and if you don't provide this D3 code, there's a sensible default. And that's actually only recent. They did, I feel like this podcast is more about React and D3 than Ember. He recently released late last year, a library. What did it do? Oh, D3 Scale, which is their, so for anyone who's not used D3, you can give, sort of the simplest use case of it is you can give ranges to D3, be like, I have 0 up to some other number, and like, give me scaling and sort of gradients between them. As an array of data.
Yeah, that's definitely been on my to-do list, actually, to make those scales available as helpers in Ember.
Yes, it's really, really good. But I think the interesting thing is, like, in and of itself is not useful at all, right? Like this library where you can take any number and be like, you know, tell me, give me like even spaced gradient between these two values. No user asks for that. That's not like a normal thing that you would ask for. But that sort of underlying primitive is incredibly useful in a ton of use cases, not just graphing. You could use it for, you know, for example, animation. It would be incredibly useful if you wanted to do tweening and needed to figure out where individual frames needed to fit so that you had a smooth animation at different frame rates. A library like that would be incredibly useful.
So one thing that's cool about, I don't want to like jump into like solution mode or anything, but like one thing that's cool about well-built abstractions is they give you access to the abstraction that they're built on in a way that sort of teaches you the underlying, like a person that decides to customize something isn't customizing that library itself now. It's there. Mm-hmm. You're actually learning the abstraction just underneath it in order to perform that customization. And that's been my experience with well-designed, well-designed components or libraries.
Yeah, and React out of the gate did a really good job of this. Not like a perfect, I wouldn't give it like an A+, but at the time, a superior job to Ember at the time. And I think since then we have been, we already had things on the roadmap that were like heading in the same direction, and as does Angular. I think everyone is moving in this direction of like composing more complex interfaces out of simpler primitives. The key benefit being, so if you're building an autocomplete and someone needs to customize what the dropdown behavior is, rather than saying like, oh, here's an option for a thing to pad it with, here's an option for the text that goes in each element of the dropdown, here's an option for the delay, here, you know, various options. You can just say like, you know, here, like we use this class for the dropdown, you're welcome to subclass it, or provide your own and make sure it matches this interface, and you know, like the outer part that does the typing detection and says whether to show or hide the dropdown will use yours instead of ours. It is a very powerful pattern, and we're only just starting to see it. And specifically in Ember, we're only just starting to see it in the past couple releases as like a first class citizen based on the primitives that we have in the framework. I think the better actions, like the action helper, was a huge part of this. And I think I'm really bad about remembering what is in release beta and Canary of Ember, because I just sort of live on Canary so much of the time. But I think contextual components are in the, like, they're in the release version now.
Yeah, I think there were so many advances that had to happen just in the templating engine, and not like, yes, not how, not the rendering, but the actual templating. Like, You know, it just none of this stuff works without like block parameters. And like you said, the action components and the contextual helpers are, you know, a huge step forward. But and I, you know, I think that that's something that, you know, other I guess like, you know, React doesn't use a templating engine at all. Yep. And so you kind of, it's all right there in JavaScript. And so the, you kind of get those advances for free. But now we're kind of getting, we're starting to realize those so that we can actually, you know, use these techniques.
One thing I think Ember is going to be able to do better than React because of the template language is allow sort of like deeper punching to sort of components that are inside components that are inside components that are inside components. So when you need to reach sort of deeply into a very structured component to customize something several levels deep, I think through having handlebars, that's going to be an easier job in Ember. Because you won't need to re-implement each of the smaller bits.
I would say that reflects our experience recently. As we've started using this technique to compose stuff together, you could be three or four levels deep and need to coordinate things. And because of the way that you're able to yield things into each other in a way that's very easy to read and thread through visually.
Yeah, it's just so much, you know, for the starters, it's just so much more concise. Like there's so much context buried underneath that handlebars template. And, you know, you don't have to deal with a JavaScript syntax. And because you know, you're essentially working with expressions and sub-expressions, you know, there's a purity there. You can't introduce, you know, ironically for the kind of framework that takes the more like imperative approach, there's a more like, you know, an inability to inject somehow get imperative code inside your handlebars templates. It's like the declarative nature is enforced.
Yeah.
So I want to kind of ground this in a couple of for people that may be listening and not quite following what we're talking about. I want to ground it in a couple of real world examples or conceptually real examples. So the example that you gave in your talk, which I still haven't seen come to fruition yet, and it's still something I want to see, which is the idea that a date picker is really nothing more than a chunk of data and a carousel and then like a popover basically, right? Mm-hmm. And if you compose a carousel and a popover with a data model behind it that you're just paging through that data, then like I actually think now in Ember you could probably pull that component together in a few hours.
Yes.
And it would be built out of stuff that you could you have a reliable popover that does the job of a popover, and you have a reliable date model that you can use, and you have a reliable carousel that you can use for other stuff.
Yep. This is, I mean, it's all very hard to talk about in a podcast because it's so visually important. But we can talk about it as a series of sort of nesting presentations and nesting behaviors. So the outermost or deepest presentation is this concept of modal behavior. And modality, people think of modals as like, primarily is that like, so imagine a modal pops up in your screen. You think of it as like that thing you interact with in the middle. I think people who study UIs would not talk about that as the modal. The modal would actually be the frame, whether it's fully opaque or semi-transparent or entirely transparent, that takes up the entire window and that has behavior around it. So if you think of modality, forget like an actual like, you know, form popping up or some sort of presentation on the screen. The modal being the outermost component, basically, it's just an overlay on top of the whole screen. So you can think of it as like an overlay component. And its behaviors are very, very simple. It takes up the full screen. It prevents scrolling on the rest of the screen. So it takes over scroll behavior. And it probably has the ability to cancel itself. So you want to be able to say, like, get out of this. And the canonical sort of user interactions around that are you can show a little X button. You also probably want to capture the escape key, so people hit escape, it goes away. So you can imagine building, you know, just that as a component, right? Like you're going to build a component, and it's just going to be this, like, you know, X dash overlay to steal your terminology for components. and the behavior it has is like it takes up the full view screen, so it's going to be probably some CSS. It takes over scrolling, probably also some CSS. It has keyboard bindings for the escape key, which will cause it to close itself. And then it may also have a subcomponent inside it, which would be this little X button. And that X button is a subcomponent. And that component's behavior is basically like, when I'm clicked, I will do whatever you've told me to do when I'm clicked. In this case, the outer component, the overlay, would tell the sort of closing X button when you were click call my, you know, close the overlay function. And that's, so that's like where actions come in. So that's sort of like the very basic premise of that pattern. And then inside of that, we could, for example, put, you know, where the user has clicked inside, for example, a form element, we may put a representation of a calendar month. Now, all the same behavior outside that has to retain. So if you think of a traditional date picker, you click into the form input, a date picker shows up. But if you click anywhere else except that date picker, you want all the overlay cancelability behavior that you had from just a plain overlay. So you add that. So basically, the date picker lives inside the overlay. And then the date picking has behavior of pagination. So you probably have two little buttons that have actions associated with them. They're just buttons that says, like, you know, when you click me, I'll do whatever you have told me to do. And in this case, you're going to have an action that says, like, move the cursor for the data I'm looking at ahead by, you know, the, whatever notional you have of, like, one month, basically. And this will move the month back and forth. And then as you select a month, you're probably interacting with an event that moves up to a text box. And, like, that's like, the canonical example of how you would implement a date picker. And then in the talk, I talk about how a photo carousel, so if you think of, if you open anyone's photo on Facebook, you have the ability to page back and forth between their previous and next photos, which is basically the same primitive behavior as paging back and forth between one month and the next. You're also reusing the same primitive overlay behavior, right? So that photo carousel is probably centered in the middle of the screen, which is different than being sort of pinned to wherever a text input is. But functionally, the overlay outside of it behaves exactly the same. If you click anywhere that's not the photo carousel, you should do the event of canceling. If anyone hits the escape key, you should do the event of canceling. It probably has the same presentation of, like, dimming the screen. It has the same event capturing of you can't scroll, it takes full screen, et cetera. And so that's like the composition of these two different elements. They're very similar. Basically, the only thing that is different is the source data, you know, photos and captions versus date, and the particular way you want to display it. So like a table of dates versus an image tag. But the underlying primitive behavior of both components is essentially identical. And so if you're designing a pattern library that you want to expose to people to use, you would have a thing like an overlay component, which in and of itself, like, doesn't do anything useful, right? Like, no user ever says, I want an overlay on the screen. That is not useful in itself. Pagination is not in and of itself a useful behavior. Showing a photo is perhaps useful in some way, but not super useful. Just having a button that you can click and does nothing else is not useful. But you put all these pieces together and you can compose both a photo carousel and a date picker out of almost exactly the same thing. And so, like, that's what I want to see, you know, not just in Ember. I would love to see this kind of everywhere, this underlying level that is not intended for basically user-facing features. It's intended to build user-facing features.
So I'm curious, because this has kind of been on my mind a little bit, is, like, you know, in when we're writing handlebars templates, you know, we have all these neat features like, you know, the dynamic component helpers and the block params. You know, if the web as a whole is to move towards this, how does that work if all we've got is HTML that doesn't have, you know, it doesn't have block params, it doesn't have the way to link up components with the dynamic helpers and things like that? Do you have any, like, thoughts on that? Because I'm, like, completely, I have no visibility. I don't see that, how that could play out.
I also have no special insight. I would say if this were like other parts of technology, it will go one of two ways. Hopefully both. One, you can think of HTML or CSS or JavaScript or basically anything as the end result, like the artifact of a programming process. It does not necessarily need to be what you're actually writing in. So you can think of HTML as, like, at some point you would have a layer of abstraction over on top of it. So it's not necessarily like the source, literally, that people are writing on their day-to-day basis. They're writing something else, and what they're writing will translate down into that. In an ideal world, that abstraction on top becomes standard in some way, or the underlying code that you're attempting to abstract over understands the use cases that you're trying to build on top of it and builds it into the native HTML or native sort of source language. So I can imagine a world where HTML could do this stuff. It obviously can't right now, but it you know, there's nothing to say HTML 6 or HTML 7
right.
would have this kind of functionality built into it.
So that we can, because you know that the dream that the Polymer folks have kind of been pushing forward is that you know you've got this huge ecosystem of components that really have a complete latitude in what the underlying technologies are, but they can mm-hmm. you know snap together. But in practice, having those practical things, those extra extensions that Handlebars provides have proven critical like to that style. So maybe what you're saying is maybe we can have HTML transpilers so we can experience the beauty of HTML 7 today.
I think that's probably the world that we're moving towards, right? Like you want a layer on top of HTML that gives you all the behaviors that you want. And like there are probably some people listening right now that think that sounds crazy. And yet the same thing for CSS sounded crazy 7 years ago and now is almost de facto standard. Like I know very few people that work sort of at the quote unquote metal level of just CSS. Most people are using something with higher level patterns that translates or you know compiles down to CSS. I think Sass is kind of the winner in this space. Interestingly enough, because for a brief period it looked like it was not going to be the winner, but now I just see Sass everywhere as the default for almost everything.
I haven't written vanilla CSS in probably a year and a half.
I think very very few people who work on applications have.
Those who are committed to vanilla CSS tend to be pretty opinionated.
Yes. So it's not even just there are app developers who do just vanilla CSS. They have many strong opinions. But there is this entire, you know, like every day someone enters the web development profession who's never heard of Sass, who has heard of CSS. You know, every day someone is born who's never heard of ES6. And you know, may not until they're depending on how long the next version takes. but you know, like that's like an additional hurdle to have to learn to do web development. And I think there are people who get very, very far with just like ES5, plain CSS, just HTML. And that's like, you know, I would not look down on them. That you know is a viable way of using the technologies that are available. They're basically picking the things that have standardized, that have the best support, the best tooling for them, and you know, opting into a world where there's just sort of universal support for the technologies that they picked, which is awesome. Because you pick these cooler technologies, and
then you have to install Node,
and then you have to install Node, right? Like, or Chrome has had better support for Sass recently, but for a long time, if you use Sass, like the whole sort of Sass cycle, or you know, more generically, sort of compiled CSS cycle in the browser was not very fun, right? You wanted to be able to like edit CSS in the browser and save it back to the system, but you can't because the CSS it's reading is essentially a compiled artifact of your development environment. And that's frustrating. Mm-hmm. But the ability to experiment with Sass and to have a large community of people experimenting with that is what really drove forward a lot of the developer tools. And now developer tools, it's very standard to have things like source map built in and the ability to write back to not just the compiled source but the source which is pretty nifty.
Indeed. So, yes, quite.
So as a listener, how do I get started doing this right now? What resources or what do I need to do to get this rolling in my applications today?
The technology in almost any framework that you're going to pick is there to do this. The piece that is missing is the thought leadering. I think you, as a developer, you just need to start thinking about the thing I'm working on, can it be deconstructed? And then continue to ask that question until the answer is no. And then you have discovered the lower level primitives and then start building those lower level primitives to assemble the larger piece that you want. Even if you never release the lower level primitives to be shared or reused, I think that leads to a more thought out piece of code, a more testable piece of code, and then at the end of the day, a more reusable and composable piece of code, whether you choose for it to be reused or composed or not. That option is open to you.
Yeah, I think you're going to, you find, or I always find that even if I only, if a piece of code only or a set of APIs that I'm using only exist in one configuration, like I've got one date widget, you still get reuse day to day as you change it and refactor it. And that's really helpful. So in a sense, you are reusing it just in the same, on the same workbench.
Yep. But it's tough. It's tough to take a an interface, or I mean, honestly, if you just generalize this to any piece of code, what are the structural primitives? What are the like the base atoms of what I'm putting together? At the lowest level, they're going to be whatever primitives your language has to offer to you. So you know, in most languages, you know, arrays, hashes, strings. In some languages, just collections of data. And then from that, like, how do you compose up larger things? And I think very frequently people go from the base primitive, and then the next layer is like what the, you know, what is user facing, or what is in the user, in this case, might be another programmer consuming your application. And I think one of the things that differentiates people with more experience from less experience is realizing the levels that live in between, sort of the interface that you want, and the interface in this case might be a visual user interface, or it might be a code user interface, an API. You know, the layers between that and the underlying bits. I think as you program more, you tend to increase the layers a bit. You know, probably too many, and then as you program even more, you shrink them down to an acceptable level. I think the canonical example is many people when they first start programming, and this is definitely true of me, are starting with something like PHP. Not to disparage React, but I think React is so approachable because it is like PHP. This is not a description of it, either a good PHP application or a good React application, but you could put all your code in one file as sort of one giant procedural bit of code. The benefits of that are all the code is right there, right? Like I think if people saw me program, they would be shocked at how many tabs in my text editor I have open, because to do a simple thing like, we need to add a new method where the user can supply bank account information. It's like, okay, cool. Well, I'm going to have the controller and it's going to delegate to the user, which will have a method that's like add bank account information. And that will probably delegate to a thing that's like, well, you know, like what payment service are we using? So I'll have a thing that's like determines what payment service they're using, and that payment service will have an interface that will have a thing that says add a payment, and that will translate probably to whatever client library the payment service has provided in the source language I'm using, which will then, and this isn't code I would write, is translating down to an HTTP request. And so for something like from the user's perspective is like, it's a form where I enter in some, you know, I enter my routing and account number. There's actually like many layers there, right? Like even just in the code I write, 5 or 6 layers, then there's an HTTP request, and there's probably 5 or 6 layers on the other end of it that will allow it to be like composed nicely. And the benefits of that are when we decide that like whatever payment service we're using is awful and we want to switch to another one, the only thing that needs to change is like, okay, well, there's one place in the user that says, what payment service are we using? And I'll just tick that over to another payment service. And the rest of the system should behave exactly the same and have like no knowledge that we've ever switched over. Like that's the other end of the spectrum from it all lives in one file and it's all right there as you look at it. And each have benefits and drawbacks. I tend to do the like many layers, many files thing. But I know that can be very frustrating to keep track of like how data is flowing through the system. But that's just how I end up programming, I think. Please clap.
I've been thinking about that all day.
We'll get a slow clap going.
Oh, this is great. Topical jokes.
The last part is like Citizen Kane first aid episode, skills.
So it's I don't know. It's emerging, and I want to see more thought leadering. I think you're right that thought leadering is actually the setting aside that that's maybe the worst phrase that's ever been invented.
Just thought leader your application.
Yeah, but the
it's TDD, thought leadering driven development.
To use another much maligned word is marketing this idea to developers in a way that feels approachable. Once you experience the benefits of this and you go, it seems very abstract to try to like pull out a layer and say, okay, what is common between these things is that it pages through data. And so we're going to write a pagination component. Mm-hmm. Like, that doesn't make any sense to most, you know, to a traditional way of developing stuff. But then you realize, wow, that's actually really useful for a lot of things. Nobody would ever sit there and lay a pagination component in their app, but they would compose something out of it. And so the ability to break things that you're doing down into their pieces can actually result in a better user experience. Because a lot of, you know, jQuery widgets is, if you crack those things open, it's a huge pile of hacks. And it's a pile of bug fixes on top of a pile of hacks that, where you talked about those, how these components have so many features that they literally can't be turned on together, versus something that's like, its job is to make sure that windows pop up and overlay and freeze scrolling reliably. And this one's job is to run a carousel reliably. That results in better user experience and without as much effort.
It's such a hard sell, right? Like D3, although it is very popular, it is not as used as complete charting libraries.
It's right. hard because you can't. I remember this was the problem that I came with D3 is I was looking for a charting library. And I didn't know SVG, and everybody was like, oh, you got to use D3. And I was like, oh, I'm struggling to like do the D3, and I don't even get any, like it doesn't even generate any DOM for me. Like, I got to do it all by hand.
Yes.
So yeah, you really have to learn kind of two technologies at the same time. I mean, the benefit then is, you know, you have one that gives you mastery over the other.
You see the output of people who are proficient with D3. I literally can't even imagine the effort it would take to build a charting library that enabled all of the data visualizations that people have built with D3. It would be massive. It would be just absolutely ridiculous. Because every day someone's inventing some new way to visualize data, and using D3 as an underlying layer, to express that as code in code. And, it would be madness to do it that way. D3, I think, is one of the best libraries to be written in the past decade. But I struggle with it. Like, I have been struggling to not even master, but just like grasp the basics of using D3 to get what I want for a long time. It is very, very difficult. And it's cool that now I'm like looking at examples they have and thinking like how I wouldn't even know how to put this together. Just the stuff is absolutely amazing. Education on these things is obviously very, very difficult.
I wonder if, in addition to education, like the idea of a primitive library that you can compose, like, you know, the 8-box of Crayola colors, right? Mm-hmm. So you have maybe 8 different components, and then you show out of these 8 components, here's, you know, Bootstrap did a good job of eventually arriving at this out of, it was hard-coded originally, but it's more composable now. Yep. But like, here's the kind of stuff you can build out of these, you know, this Crayola box of 8 crayons, you can build, you know, 15 different projects and let people use the individual projects. But yeah, the hard part is convincing a few people as library authors to step in and start building some of that stuff. Because it's really hard work to come up with those abstractions.
It is very, very hard work, and it's in and of itself is not rewarding, because the thing you're building is not, it's like this awful level between underlying library and user facing. Like, underlying library work I really enjoy doing, so just like pure functions or sort of utility libraries, I think is super fun. I love building user interfaces. In between them, there's this like thankless world of like bigger than a library but not in and of itself useful for a thing. Like, you could not ship it to anyone and they would care. You couldn't build a complete feature by just saying like, I pulled in this library and I exposed it to the user and it's a complete feature. And that is very thankless work, which is, I suspect, why nobody is doing it.
Yeah. I wonder if we're going to see more of these, you know, underlying libraries that are shared between, you know, shared that are essentially independent of a particular framework or a particular technology, because, you know, like at its core, a lot of these things, even though like an overlay, like we were talking about earlier, has a visual component, you know, underneath it, it's really just a piece of data and a set of actions that are defined to operate on that data, right? Like, is it showing?
Yep.
And, you know, so you have an action that's like show it, that sets the state to is showing true. And then the cancel, which is, you know, another action that toggles it off. And, you know, I'm sure maybe there's more in there, but like there's not really, you know, that workflow, that data and the operations that act on it really is kind of feels independent of, you know, of any one particular, even a DOM. Like it seems like I ought to be able to somehow capture that workflow and use it in a iOS application.
Absolutely. The missing piece is the yielding internally, right? Like how do you design the interface where you have a thing where it's like, okay, now you put your code here, because, you know, at the time of this airing, the popular JavaScript frameworks and other UI frameworks and other platforms don't have a contractual interface for how rendering and it occurs.
Right.
And maybe that's where like the HTML spec authors or JavaScript spec authors need to jump in and be like, okay, cool. Like for interop between these libraries, here is the standard. Please adhere to the standard. The question would be like, would people adhere to the standard? I can speak as someone at Ember Core, we're, you know, deeply interested in standards compliance. A lot of the things that we do, part of this is because Yuda and I think possibly Steph now are on TC39, or at least involved in TC39 activities. We are deeply concerned with making sure Ember is using forward-facing features, and if forward-facing features do not exist, writing our own features in a way that we know we can, that are like most compatible with what is likely to occur, sort of like reasonably to occur in the future spec. And oftentimes we get really banged for it. I remember we started doing the ES6 module conversion of Ember 2013. It was like 3 years ago. And at the time, just hugely controversial, absolutely controversial. People thought we were just absolutely out of our minds to be doing module conversion when CommonJS was so popular, just because it was the standard. But we want the longevity. We want to expose to people who have said, I'm going to opt into the Ember ecosystem, a path to the future, such that they can write an Ember application now and hopefully require minimal syntax changes many, many years and many, many versions into the future. The Ember object system, right? Like right now I get a lot of questions from people at work and just sort of around town and on the internet, like, why does Ember have this weirdo object system? Why not just use ES6 classes? And the answer was like, well, in 2011, there wasn't even a notion of ES6 classes, and the Ember object system is a fairly close approximation to what the ES6 class system turned out to be, partially through thinking through that problem very deeply, partially through having people on those committees who could argue, like, you know, we've built object systems, here's what we've run into, here are the problems that you have to face, here are the solutions that, like, we need to offer answers for these questions. The particulars of what those answers are maybe aren't as important, but like we do need to answer them. I forget why I started on this rant. This often happens when I rant about things. Well, you get it's just a rant.
Rabble.
I'll add something, which I think is kind of like, so full disclaimer, I've been doing Ember for quite a while, since 2012, 2013. And I was definitely like one of those people who was like, JavaScript build tools, let's learn them all, let's like do the thing. Like I've done my time with basically all of the build tools now.
Yep.
From Grunt, Gulp, RequireJS, Rails, everything, familiar with all of it. At this point, the main thing that was blocking me to React was like, I don't want to like give up my ES6. I don't want to give up like SAS. I don't want to like have this unique pipeline for building my stuff. And I think Ember is really unique in the JavaScript landscape for this because of stuff like Ember CLI. Like, I upgraded an application recently to use Ember CLI 2. There's a little bit of work involved, but overall wasn't too bad. But I noticed in my application that my CSS was like no longer, or the page didn't reload when I changed my CSS. And I was like, that's weird. Like, live reload totally worked in Ember CLI 1. And what I didn't notice was that I was doing some like very minor font changes, is that the page was just like updating it live for me. And so while that technology of like doing these live CSS updates has been around for a year or two, like you could have used it at any time, while Ember CLI can get stuff either just as fast or just as slow, it depends who wants to bring it in. It's like I always reap that benefit of like, oh, like ES6 or Babel, like other people are looking at it. I get to benefit from it. I get to write my app. And I'm like just really grateful the Ember ecosystem like embraces standards in a way that makes it incredibly easy and maintainable in the long term for you to keep up with like even just JavaScript or SAS or whatever.
Yeah. That was actually fantastic. I remember we went from like Espresso to 6 to 5 to Babel, and we didn't like do anything really. Like all the underlying transpiler technology was just churning away. And yeah,
it's funny because it's like people talk about, you know, JavaScript fatigue right now is like the hot topic. I imagine there will be many conference talks about JavaScript fatigue in the next 6 to 9 months. And I think the Ember community, portions of the Ember community have felt that fatigue as well. And it's mainly the portions who contribute to the tools, right? Like as we were moving through the various compilers of JavaScript to JavaScript, people working on those tools felt a ton of the fatigue of moving them around. But to the average person who writes an Ember application and is just using these tools, like you said, you just don't even know, right? Like I remember when Ember CLI was first being developed and people were, you know, pretty butthurt about which build technology we picked. So for those who don't know, under the hood, Ember CLI uses Broccoli, which is a build technology that Joe Liss helped sort of come up with conceptually and build the initial versions of. And I think Steph and Robert have been like driving that forward very heavily for the past year. People are like, oh, why didn't you use Grunt? Why didn't you use Gulp? And the answer, which was just like really unacceptable to people, was like, it doesn't matter. That is an abstraction underneath the layer that you should be interacting with. You should say like, build my Ember app, right? Or like, compile my CSS. And you shouldn't need to care what mechanism is used underneath that to do that. Like it's like purposely architected in a way that if the Broccoli experiment had gone south very quickly, we could have swapped it out for Gulp or Grunt and no one would have noticed. Now there is some concept of like authorship.
And we
right?
did
like
you, try Grunt as well.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I forget that you do the Ember CLI stuff too. Stanley's just everywhere.
Well, I basically had nothing to do with Ember CLI. I just remember Ember AppKit was around for quite a while and like trying to keep that up to date. What people don't realize is when it comes to like, so I agree with you that like ultimately it doesn't matter. Secondly, I think people like are like, well, I need to do like all this like module splitting stuff and blah, blah, blah. And whatever, and it's just like, okay, maybe you do in your application or whatever, and maybe Ember or CLI can help make that possible. But for like the default of like, I just want to like spike out a new component. I want to like try out some new add-on. Or maybe I'm new and like I really don't care, but could I get something deployed easily? So Ember kind of makes that trade-off of like, well, the build system is like, I guess you'll have to learn Broccoli if you really want to customize it, versus like, well, you're going to have to learn that up front and...
No matter what.
Yeah. Do that.
Which is, it's weird because like there is a certain segment, and I think this is the majority of JavaScript developers, somehow hold this tension in their brain simultaneously of, I don't want people making decisions for me because they might make the wrong decision. Oh, but there are so many decisions to make. I'm so tired of making decisions. And it's like, it just doesn't make sense to me.
I can empathize because that's me at the grocery store, which is like why I will like go on a website that's like, here's a meal plan for the week. And I'm like, okay, if I don't like something, I'll try and find something else. Otherwise, like my grocery shopping is like done for me. Otherwise, I will literally spend 2 hours at the grocery store because one, I'm already hungry. And two, I'm just like, do I get the orange juice? I don't know.
Just... And like, you know, is store brand Velveeta as delicious as the real
it's
thing?
Not.
You don't
no,
know.
There's certain things you never, you always buy name brand, and Velveeta is one of those.
It's a trust thing.
I would never wash my hair with anything else.
I would never. I also use only. No, just kidding. Yeah, no. The tyranny of choice is a horrendous problem, which in my experience tends to affect people who already have like anxiety issues anyway. And so it's just adding insult to injury. We're like, I'm really awkward in social situations, and then also I have to choose between 53 similar things. This is the worst ever. Which is why I'm such a fan of Wirecutter.
The Wirecutter and their like sister site, The Sweet Home.
Yes.
Like,
literally,
so great.
My friend Sean and I, when we need to buy a thing, I'm like, oh, I bought boots. And he's like, did you buy the Wirecutter boots? I'm like, of course. I don't want to go through all the work of figuring out what the best pair of boots is. I just went on the Wirecutter and they did all the work for me. And like,
so then the nice thing about the Wirecutter and Sweet Home is like, so there's no shortage of like best of articles.
Yes.
But the problem is with the best of articles you see on the internet is they're like, oh, I was recently trying to figure out like an automatic coffee maker. And so like, I'm looking and like, okay, like I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be like researching or whatever. I don't want to do AeroPress. I don't want to do X. I just want a coffee maker. And so like the first like three pages of Google are like all articles that are like, we narrowed it down to like 25 coffee makers for you. And we're not really telling you anything about any of them.
Yes. Like, the problem is
we didn't do a taste test. We didn't do
XYZ. Those
and
sites are always... data, not information.
Yeah, and the nice thing about the Wirecutter too is that like they're like, okay, we have a number one pick, but like say you're on a budget or you have this other common criteria, here's a couple of other good picks just in case.
Okay, and so Stanley,
all your decisions are made.
Stanley and Trek's pick. We don't do
the
picks, but Stanley and Trek's pick is the Wirecutter. I check their section on which JavaScript framework you should use. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, it says Ember. no, I literally have like the standing mat, the standing desk, the headphones, I'm just like everything in my office and my home is like someone has done the research and has listed in detail why they have said this is the best thing. And I read through the reasons and like, I also agree these are the reasons I would say something is the best thing, and so I trust your decision, and I'm going to do the best thing. Because I'm so lazy, and I think that's, like, it's exactly the pitch I have for Ember. Like, I really like React. Here's my problem with React. Most people should not be using React, because to scale with React, you need to make a lot of decisions you probably have no context in. I feel like I have the context to make those decisions. I also know I'm probably 100% wrong that I have the context to make those decisions. And I'm going to make horrendous technical decisions that either me or my teammates have to live with for the next however long it takes before someone does a gigantic rewrite of whatever we're working on. And the pitch for Ember, I think, is there's so many people adding their voice to a consensus of like, here's a great way to do this. Maybe not the best way, but like a great way for the most number of people that like it's really hard to go wrong. Sometimes you're wrong, for sure. But for the like on the balance, I have seen Ember make the right decisions over and over again, and that is incredibly impressive to me. And it's not even just the core team, right? Like we so much feedback comes from the community.
Yep. Well, Trek, we have used up a ton of your time, and but this was really fun. And I really appreciate it. And I also want to say it's like not enough to just say something, but I want to say thank you for all the stuff that you've done in open source. When I was first learning Ember, the documentation was non-existent to abysmal. And the amount of work that you put into that project, the amount of work you put into the framework, the thoughtfulness you bring to it, it has had a positive effect on my career tremendously. And so... you don't recognize the impact you have on other people's lives when you're kind of sitting getting yelled at in GitHub issues. But I want you to know like that matters to a lot of us that we don't stop and say thank you. And so I wanted to make sure to do that.
If Aaron, our podcast editor, is listening and like do we have the rights to Andrew Gold's thank you for being a friend? The theme for Golden Girls.
It's worth mine.
Can you play us off with that?
We can do like what 30 seconds of it, and it's considered. No, what we should do is we should record Stanley singing it. And I think it's considered parody.
I'm down
at that
for this.
Point.
Yeah.
It's definitely fair use. All right. Well, with that, we should wrap up and let people know, like, if you have any questions for Trek, they may be directed at him. He is Trek Bicycles on Twitter. And if you have any questions for us, we're The Front Side on Twitter, and we'd love to hear any other thoughts you have or anything that you feel like we should have asked Trek or that we need to bring him back on for. I think Trek, I could do just one of these with you every dang week. It's really fun talking with you.
You know how I love to talk.
Well, we appreciate your time. So for all of us at The Front Side, thanks everybody for listening, and we will talk to you again soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for being a friend.